You're listening to Ballot Box Radio on 95.7 FM, low-power community radio for Minneapolis.
Even at big corporate-owned media outlets, there are still a number of journalists inclined to uncover truths about society. Who holds economic power? Why wages are falling? Why the military budget is still so bloated while central cities are decapitalized? But mergers can be intimidating to journalists, and not just because of the layoffs that often follow. Think back to 1990, before Disney owned ABC, when that network's Primetime Live aired a hard-hitting report on the negative impacts of Disney theme parks on the environment and communities of Central Florida. The report titled Tragic Kingdom focused on Disney's greed. Can you imagine such a report airing now on ABC? The Disney Company has political interests in trade, labor, tax, and telecommunications policy. Disney sells items of clothing in the United States for $11 that Haitian workers get paid 7 cents apiece for. With Disney as ABC's corporate parent, journalists may well avoid certain stories about labor exploitation and free trade.
Issues and answers, interviews and comments. Radio for the 1997 campaign. Ballot Box Radio, 95.7 FM, Minneapolis.
Hey, this is Linus again. I don't mean to interrupt Janet Deluxe and Matt here on the air, but we would really like your feedback on a particular issue, and we think there's some stories out there that need to be told. The comment line is 439-2484. What we're wondering is, have you had experiences with crime where you live? Have you had any muggings, any car break-ins, any damage to your house, your apartment? And if so, call us up at 439-2484. Tell us your story. Let us know, did the police department help you out? Did the city help you out? Were you pleased with the results that you got? Whatever your story is, call us up on the comment line. Let us know, okay? That seems to be a hot issue between the candidates in this year's election, and we like to know what the public is thinking. Back to the music.
Good morning or afternoon, everyone. You're listening to 95.7 FM, Ballot Box Radio. That was Groove Is in the Heart by D-Light. And before that, we heard Joking by the Indigo Girls. Starting off the set, of course, was The Best by Tina Turner.
Woohoo! That was our all-women segment of the show.
Hey, Janet, I know what we're getting for Thanksgiving.
What is that?
Tofurkey.
Tofurkey? What is that, Matt?
Well, I don't know. Wait. Tofurkey is one answer to the question of what's an appropriate Thanksgiving dish for vegetarians. Apparently, it's a turkey made out of tofu. You know, in retrospect, it sounds actually rather vile. What do you think?
I don't know. If it tastes kind of like turkey, I might enjoy it.
I don't know.
Don't forget to give us a call at our comment line. We've been receiving your calls all morning and afternoon, and we do appreciate it. It's 439-2484.
In the meantime, here's more music with some ABBA.
You're listening to Ballot Box Radio, 95.7 FM, the new community radio station for uptown, downtown, and campus area.
I can move any mountain.
Hi, this is Linus on Ballot Box Radio 95.7 FM. We've got a special guest on the line. We're going to do a phone interview with Robert McChesney. And Mr. McChesney is an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Are you there, Mr. McChesney? Are you there, Bob?
Yes, I am, Lyman.
All right. Thanks very much for taking time out of your day-to-day to talk with us here in Minneapolis.
My pleasure. Are we on live or is this a tape?
We're on live.
Hey, great.
So,
Hello, Twin Cities.
Yeah, all right. Did you get snow there in Wisconsin? We got some this morning.
No, but I think you're really up in sort of like the Siberian plain compared to us. We consider this the Sun Belt.
I see. Well, let's go down to Madison, you guys. All right. Mr. McChesney is the author of a book called Corporate Media and the Threat to Democracy, and that's part of the Open Media Pamphlet series. Now, Bob, here at Ballot Box Radio, we've been covering the upcoming election here in Minneapolis, and we've been discussing issues about micropower radio. So in your book, you start off by saying that democracy requires that there be an effective system of political communication, broadly construed, that informs and engages the citizenry, drawing people meaningfully into the polity. How do you see micro-broadcasting fitting that system?
Well, let's just start with that point, the importance of having a good media system or a viable media system to have a democracy. That's really a cornerstone point of virtually any democratic theory that's ever been written. I know of no democratic theory that isn't predicated on that. So to the extent that we do not have that sort of system in the U.S., we do not really have a democracy. I mean, it's not that it's the only factor, but it's an essential factor in a meaningful democracy. So I think the starting point for understanding where micro-broadcasting fits in is to sort of take a look at the lay of the land of our press system, of our media system today in the United States. And then once you sort of get the lay of the land, then you say, okay, now understanding that, where does micro-broadcasting fit in? And if you look at the general contours of our media system in the United States today, it's not a very positive picture. What we see increasingly is a media system which across the board is dominated by really 10 or 11 enormous corporations. Most of these corporations, maybe all of them really, have holdings across all sorts of different media sectors. So they're big players in TV, radio, book publishing, film studios. They're true corporate conglomerates, and they increasingly dominate our mass media. Moreover, they are firms that have tremendous power in Washington, D.C. over politicians, simply because they're wealthy and powerful corporations, which, of course, is a given, but also because politicians don't like to mess with the media. It's perfectly okay to bash the media for being liberals and for sex and violence, but it's absolutely not okay to get in their way when it comes time to make money or to make profits. So these large firms basically are super powerful. In fact, the Wall Street Journal just about 3 weeks ago ran a front page story declaring that the commercial broadcasters are the single most powerful lobby in Washington. They're basically unbeatable. That's their strength. So we're in a situation where we have a media system, instead of being competitive, instead of being open to all or even many, is controlled by a handful of enormous firms that have really sort of a vice grip on the media. It's virtually impossible to compete with them due to their market power. And these are firms that are hardly neutral in terms of what they're going to cover. On one hand, commercial imperatives satisfying Madison Avenue and advertisers pushes the content in one direction. In another way, these are firms that have distinct stakes in the outcome of very important issues like GATT and NAFTA, tax issues about regulation of business, issues dealing with labor. And because of that, what we get is a general nature of coverage in our media system that is hostile to anti-business, to populist, to pro-working class or labor positions. That's one of the striking features of our media system. So when you look at our media system that way, a tightly run system owned by a handful of corporations that basically has Washington in its hip pocket. I mean, these guys floss their teeth with politicians' underpants. When you look at it that way, then you say, well, what can we do? What are our options? And micro-broadcasting is really one of the many options that people are pursuing. And it's especially fitting in radio because as listeners in Minneapolis and the St. Paul know, just like listeners everywhere else, the past 2 or 3 years, we've seen a consolidation of ownership of radio stations more than any other industry in this country. The Telecommunications Act of 1996, the major bill that sort of set the new law for regulating radio, TV, and the internet, all electronic communication, and telephony, telephone usage. This law lifted or relaxed many of the restrictions on ownership of radio. So now we've got a situation where most of the small radio firms have been bought by bigger firms, and the medium-sized have been bought by the biggest ones, and the very largest ones, like CBS, which is owned by Westinghouse, you know, now own almost 200 stations. Westinghouse, for example, in the 12 largest markets in this country, in 9 of those 12, it owns multiple stations and has like around 40% of the audience through its multiple stations. So what we have in radio is truly the absurdity of a capitalist media system, because here is the technology in radio, which is the least expensive of any major electronic communication. It's the technology which is most open to local utilization, having decentralized, locally oriented content. And it's a technology now that, due to capitalism and nothing to do with anything else, due to the power of these firms, is being colonized by a handful of super giant firms. So they can sort of punch press their inexpensive content out to, you know, 100 stations at a time, reducing labor costs, reducing local content, satisfying what advertisers want with their pre-formatted styles. And it's turned radio, which should be the most vibrant medium, or one of the most vibrant mediums in our society, into a vending machine.
Yeah, that's so very true, and the people of Minneapolis have experienced that firsthand with the buyout and change of many stations here in the market.
Now, it's happened everywhere. It's not just Minneapolis.
That's true. That should be noted.
There's not a city in the country that has not had total upheaval in its radio market in the past 18 months.
In talking about these large corporations that dominate the media, Ben Bagdikian publishes a book called The Media Monopoly, and he's at the fifth edition now, I believe.
That's right.
He says that there used to be 50 firms that dominated the media back in the 80s, and in 92 there was about two dozen, and since then there's fewer than 10, as you were saying. Now the five largest of those are News Corporation, Time Warner, Disney, Viacom, and TCI.
That's right.
And you also, in your book, you also go on to say that because these corporations own so much, that the U.S. and global media and communication market exhibits tendencies not only of an oligopoly, but of a cartel, or at least a gentleman's club, and that just seems so very true.
Yeah, let me explain that a little bit. I mean, generally what you have in media is what's called an oligopolistic market, and what that means is that instead of being a competitive market where like hundreds or thousands of people competing, you usually just have a handful of firms that dominate it, two or three at the low end, up to maybe 10 or 12 at the high end. And almost all major U.S. industries are oligopolies. You know, we only have a few beer companies, a few car companies, a few running shoe manufacturers, a few perfume companies. That's standard in capitalism, that competition gives way to oligopoly. And in fact, one of the big lies of our age, and one of the big lies perpetrated upon the American people, is that capitalism is all about competition. Capitalism is all about eliminating competition. You love competition if you're a capitalist for your competitors and in competitor markets. But in the markets you're competing in, the successful capitalist does everything in his or her power to eliminate competition. Bill Gates is worth $40 or $50 billion today, not because he enjoys competition, but because he has basically terminated it in his industry. If he was in a very competitive industry, let's say he was selling hot dogs in downtown St. Paul, he would probably be worth $50, not $50 billion, because he would be in an extremely competitive industry. So there's a strong anti-competitive impulse built right into the market system, because the less competition you have, the more profitable you are, the less risk you face. And any intelligent or surviving capitalist understands this instantly. But what we have in the media today is even not just an oligopoly. In an oligopolistic market where you just have a handful of firms, the genius of it for the firms is it's virtually impossible for new firms to enter to compete. So if there are only five firms making running shoes, or four firms, it's very difficult for another firm that's not making running shoes to come in and be a legitimate competitor. And I won't go into the details of that. This is something that economists study, but it's just one of the empirical facts we can observe, is that once a stable oligopolistic market exists in any industry, it it's extremely unlikely for new competition to emerge. And historically, the new competitors in these markets have usually come from abroad. Take the car industry, which is dominated by what was called the Big Three in this country for generations. And then it got new competition primarily from Japan and to a lesser extent from Europe. And now in the globalized market, that option is really foreclosing too, as all the main industries are becoming global. Unless, you know, new firms start up on Mars or Venus or something.
Yeah, right.
But so we've had an oligopolistic market, which is not a very good thing by economic terms for consumers. But what we really have in the last 10 years, even the last 5 years, what's developed has been that the largest media firms increasingly are partners with each other in projects where they each own a chunk of a project. So if you take the 9 largest U.S. media firms, or the 8 largest U.S. media firms, which are the 5 you mentioned, plus General Electric, which owns NBC, and Universal, which is owned by Seagram,
right.
And who else am I missing? I'm missing someone else.
Time Warner? Capital Group?
No, but if you take the 8 largest U.S. media firms, what you discover is that of these 8 largest firms, they have joint ventures with 6 of the other 7 on average. So they have, actually they're partners with the people they're competing with. Rupert Murdoch, the owner of News Corporation, which owns Fox Broadcasting and 20th Century Fox Studios and TV Guide and the Fox News Channel and all tons of newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
Rupert Murdoch put it best. He said, when we're looking to go into a market, we have 2 choices. We can either go in and compete with someone, kill each other, and then make a deal with them, or we can make a deal first. Well, the rational thing for the smart capitalist is to make the deal first.
Right.
John Malone, the head of TCI, the cable giant, also put it. He said, it's really hard to get angry at your competition anymore because you compete with them in one market, they're your best customers in another market, and your partners in a third market. And that's really why it's almost like a cartel in many respects. So when a new technology comes along, rather than having the sort of ferocious competition that Jack Kemp and Milton Friedman and Dan Quayle always are telling us we're going to have, instead what you're much more likely to see is the big boys get together and sort of carve up the pie for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing that right now with with satellite broadcasting and cable television. The largest firms basically have agreed not to really compete, and they've each divvied up the market.
Yeah. Once again, this is Linus on Ballot Box Radio 95.7 FM. We're talking with Robert McChesney, author of the book Corporate Media and the Threat to Democracy, and he is the assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Now, how come we didn't hear about the Telecom Act, the act that made all this possible?
Well, this Telecom Act, which passed in 1996, was the first major communications law that was passed in this country since 1934. So the law it replaced had been in existence for 50 or 62 years before being replaced. It's a law of fundamental importance. It basically is one of the 3 or 4 most important laws, really, of this generation. It will determine the future of television. It was the last public say we had on the course of television in the next generation or two. The future of radio, the future of the internet. All these things, basically, Congress signed off on all those issues when this law was passed 18 months ago. Why didn't we hear about it? Well, because it wasn't covered in the press. It simply was not a reported story. It was covered one place and covered extensively, so I was reading about it regularly, and that was in the business press and the trade press for these industries. There it received extensive coverage, and it was covered primarily, exclusively even, as a story of interest to investors and managers. Where can you make the most money as a result of this bill? Which industry is going to get the best deal? Nowhere ever was it covered as an issue of significance to citizens, to the public. They had simply no stake in these debates, and it was not covered. It didn't seem of any interest to the general public. When in fact, of course, the future of television, radio, the internet is of clear importance to the survival and the nature of our society as a democracy. There was no coverage for the public. Now, this does not mean that this is a conspiracy, that there was some sort of conscious effort to keep the people deluded. Basically, what it reflects is the fact that there was intense debate over the Telecommunications Act in Washington prior to its passage, but the debate was among the huge, giant communication and media sectors with each other. So the long-distance companies were battling it out with the local phone companies over who would get the best terms. Or the cable TV companies were duking it out with the broadcasting networks over who would get the best terms in the law. But there was no place for the public to intervene. So it was covered routinely in the press by business reporters, because they were the ones who usually handled the speed. It was never